This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, and it's just a real pleasure to be here and have an opportunity to tell about some of our work in marine drug discovery. And so it's continuing this theme of oceans and human health, integrating large-scale metabolomics with the discovery of new neurotherapeutics from the sea. And before I do so, though, I'd like to give a little bit of introduction to our Center for Marine Drug Discovery, Biotechnology and Biomedicine, CMBB, which is here at Scripps, and is a part of a really grand vision that you heard some about this morning from the Chancellor and from Dr. Leenan, our director. UCSD is very connected between the various components, from Scripps Institution of Oceanography through to our wonderful School of Pharmacy, the rich campus setting with outstanding biochemistry and chemistry departments, and then our medical center with our Moores Cancer Center being world-class in terms of the treatment of diseases. So the vision of going from seaside all the way to bedside is one that's very intriguing and I think is conceivable at a campus with this kind of robust number of departments that support that kind of activity. And so in the CMBB, we have some 7 faculty that have collectively about 50 students and postdoctoral scientists, so a really extraordinary group of individuals that contribute to this effort. And we're ourselves very interactive with many joint publications, joint grants, and a lot of those types of interactions. Now, the inspiration for this is that, in fact, most of our pharmaceuticals that we currently enjoy actually, in some sense, derive from nature. That is, they are natural products themselves. In green, we have natural products and natural product derivatives, about 25% of all of our drugs. About 1,355. Biologics and vaccines are a growing number of our pharmaceuticals. And then about 50% of the pie are synthetic compounds. But where did synthetic chemists get the ideas for those substances? They, in fact, got their ideas in large part from nature. And these parts of the pie are all synthetic compounds, which are taken from nature, a pharmacophore, a basic fundamental property, and then elaborated with or decorated with features that give it good pharmaceutical properties. And so that's an important aspect of the drug discovery process. So how has the marine world done in this regard? Has it contributed very much in the way of actual agents going into the clinic? Well, this slide captures, I think, the enthusiasm or the excitement we all feel when we consider the unique adaptations that these life forms adapt to an underwater lifestyle in their unusual shapes and sizes and colors, but they're just as unusual in their underlying chemistries and biochemistries. And it's hooking into that very unusual chemistry and biochemistry that we're doing in our Scripps Institution of Oceanography drug discovery efforts. And when we encounter these compounds from the marine world, they're unlike really any other molecule that's seen on the planet, very different from things that come from the terrestrial world. So it's a really fascinating area in which to explore. And so there's, in fact, some 13 drugs that we can point to that are used in the clinic today in different parts of the world, largely in the area of cancer in these yellow tags, but also to treat hyperlipidemic conditions, some therapeutic macromolecules, proteins, and the likes. And this very interesting agent here, which is used to treat pain, it's a cyclic peptide that actually is the exact one of the peptides that's taken from the cone snail. The cone snail injects a suite of toxins into its fish prey, immediately immobilizing them. But one of these peptides has found a therapeutic application in treatment of chronic pain. So that brings me to one dimension of our program. In my lab, we have several foci on cancer and inflammation, but also in the neurosciences. And, you know, the human brain, and we heard a mention of this morning by the Chancellor of the Obama's Brain Initiative in 2014 and the mapping of the human brain. Here, an organ so central to our life And yet it's probably the least well understood in terms of how it works and of the therapeutics that we might employ to treat disorders of the brain. And that's revealed in part by looking at the attrition rate of new agents that go into the marketplace or attempt to go into the marketplace for treating central nervous system disorders. It's second or third behind oncology and women's health in terms of failing to bring the agent forward to clinical application. So very difficult to move these compounds into the clinic. And it's not that we don't need to. In fact, we have a very pressing need for new pharmaceuticals to treat these very frightening neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, Huntington's disease. There's no therapeutic agent to treat that disease at the present time. And other kinds of problems affecting the central nervous system like drug addiction and pain. And that's exacerbated even further when we consider the future, taken from this report that predicts there's going to be some 13 million Alzheimer's patients in the United States alone by the 2050. And that will cost, in terms of Medicare and Medicaid, some $1,000 billion, $1 trillion in costs. And compare that with the research funding that's shown in the small red line and predicted out, less than $1 billion is going into development of understanding of the diseases and their potential treatment of the underlying causes. At present time, at best, we treat symptoms. We don't treat causes. So that brings me to our area, my area of focus, which is to explore the marine life for their unique secondary metabolites, particularly focused on algae and, in this case, on cyanobacteria. And cyanobacteria, you may know by a different name, as it exists on in small lakes and ponds. You might call this pond scum. It's perhaps the stuff that's floating on the surface and looks not so nice. But it turns out they're amazing creatures. They're ancient organisms on the planet. They go way back in the geologic record, and 3.5 billion years. And they have extraordinary capacities to make diverse molecular structures that have very potent biological activity. So it's been a wonderful career for me to explore the secondary metabolites of marine cyanobacteria. And in this regard, in today's talk, I've been connected with, and again, showing the connections within the university, with Dr. Vivian Hook, who is an outstanding neuroscientist up in the School of Pharmacy with a joint appointment in the School of Medicine. And Dr. Hook's interests are really in the area of neuropeptides that are so central to the interaction of neurons in our bodies. And they have many diverse functions in metabolism, but also in various neurological conditions, such as in pain relief, cognition, learning, memory, and neuronal differentiation. It includes such compounds as that you may well know, the endorphins, but many others, as you can see from this list. And how these molecules are produced is very interesting. It's a sort of a basic science area that Dr. Hook is exploring. We actually have a joint student that is contributing to these efforts, but studies of these proteases, the cathepsins, they're enzymes that are responsible for the production of the endorphins and other such neuropeptides. They're produced as a result of protein synthesis in the cell body of a neuron. And then as that protein is transported on microtubules down the axon of the neuron, they're converted from full-length proteins to neuropeptides. So the enzymes are cleaving out the neuropeptide. And that's then released from the synapse, where it then is received at a receptor at a downstream neuron and exert its activity. So as it has evolved from her understanding of this process and that of others, is that these are actually very interesting drug targets to modify or modulate the activity of these cathepsins that are producing these, in that we might be able to alter the production levels, increase or decrease the amount of neuropeptide that's produced naturally. So the work then intersects with my laboratory, with some of our work in Panama. We actually have a worldwide collection program in the tropics where these marine cyanobacteria predominate. And but we, for about 15 years, by a National Institutes of Health program, have been studying the algae and cyanobacteria from the Pacific and Atlantic coasts, specifically from the National Park System. And from this area up in the Caribbean, Piedras Galinas in Panama, we made a collection that is the focus of one story I'll tell today. Diving there is quite exciting, beautiful underwater, but turning our attention into the reef, you can see a thick encrustation of diverse marine life, including many cyanobacteria. And looking more closely, you might see some of these fine filamentous hairs attached to the substrate, but growing up like hairs, and in fact gives rise to the nickname of this organism is mermaid's hair. And really, they truly look like hair grown here or in the laboratory where we are able to grow this bacterium, but it's an enormous bacterium, as you can see. And so collection of that it now interfaces with some of the new thinking and technologies that we're applying here at UCSD, and I'm very excited to be a part of it, and many others on campus are collaborating to develop some new algorithms for doing this type of work. Let me explain briefly and then illustrate it, and we can certainly have discussion afterwards. But basically, we go into the field and we make our collections of these different cyanobacteria, and we extract them for their organic chemicals, and then we separate them by HPLC, high-performance liquid chromatography, where we inject the mixture and off come individual compounds. And then we analyze those individual compounds by mass spectrometry, which tells us the size of those molecules individually, as well as we break them apart into their fragments. And those fragments are deeply revealing of the initial structure that they came from. And so the new thinking that comes from the Peter Dorstein lab and Nuno Bendera lab up in the School of Pharmacy, but we are contributing to, is that those patterns of fragments can be related one to the other, and we can see families of related compounds by an algorithm that's been created here, such that these individual spots, it's a translation of these spectra to individual compounds or spots, and they're connected by edges that are revealing the relationship between them, saying these two are a part of a family, these two are a part of a family, and are distant related from this third family. And that's a very powerful way to look at small data sets, but it can be applied to big data sets. And that's what we're doing now, is we've analyzed every sample that we've ever collected from any ocean around the planet. 3,500 samples has generated more than 30 million spectra. And that would take a long, long time to assimilate and see it and gain any insights from. But this graphical representation is really assisting this in that we can, as you can see, there's many, many, many compounds. Each one of these little spots is a compound, and they come in many different little groups. These are clusters or families of related compounds. And so what can we do with this? We can add in metadata. For instance, in here, this case, we have the location of collection, like Palmyra Atoll yielded these little clusters of compounds down there. Or we can add in bioassay data, anti-cancer, or from the neuroscience assays. And then we can find if this compound is a new compound or a known one. We can find compounds in a series that we're interested in, for instance, related to other compounds we've discovered. Or that it's a fundamentally new natural product, like this is a new cluster of compound that's never been seen before. What kind of properties does that have? And we can ground truth this with our compounds that we've studied over the years and actually characterized very, very carefully by fundamental principles and add them electronically to this data set. It's very fluid and flexible. So we can just add them in and see that, this cluster is that class of compound and this cluster is that class of compound. So it's a really very powerful algorithm for looking at these big sets of compounds. Basically, all the answers to our questions are revealed or present on that graph. And we just need to come up with good questions like, where's the good anti-cancer compound? Where's the good lead in the neurosciences? So this led us, in this case, I'm of course abbreviating quite a bit of work in the interest of time, to a discovery that is really, I think, getting very exciting. It's a compound from Piedras Galinas in Panama, as I said, is this kind of peptidic-like compound, but it has some modified portions that give it special properties. We initially isolated it as an anti-cancer compound, and then subsequently we found it to be an extraordinarily potent compound to these proteases, the cathepsins, that are involved in making these neuropeptides, selectively to cathepsin L, and this has some very attractive potential applications to pain, drug addiction, and to improving cognition. Okay, so it's a drug lead. What do we do with it? Well, this is another place where we can take it in the next step on this campus, so that we have access to some of the world leaders in so many different disciplines. Annie McGammon is world recognized as one of the great minds of our time in terms of doing modeling of proteins and small molecules that bind to them. And so we've worked with his laboratory to bind our guainamide in the active site of the cathepsin L enzyme. And we found that it bound very nicely and energy minimized in there. But we also saw there was another cavity over here that the compound wasn't exploring, and that maybe we could get better potency and selectivity if we made an analog structure that did explore that space. And so we were able to synthesize that molecule, and recently, just last week actually, tested and found that it was 30 times more active than the natural product, which gives it a potency of 150 picomolar, which is of, this is drug quality in terms of lead, and very, very exciting. Okay, I have a second very short story to share with you that is coming from another sort of orthogonal side of our work, and that is from the realm of genomics. As I said, we're working with marine cyanobacteria, and there's three such here, and we've been working with these particular strains from field collections as well as from in the laboratory cultures for some years, and they've yielded very interesting molecular structures, unlike, as I say, anything that we would find in the terrestrial environment. And they have some pretty interesting biological activities. But for today's talk, we were interested, and we've been interested, to sequence their genomes, all their DNA and genetic information. And so we've achieved that, and we have quite large genome sizes for bacteria, which are typically 3 or 4 or 5 megabases. These are roughly double that, at about 8.5 to 9.5 megabases, which means they have a lot of extra genetic information for storing or encoding for the biosynthesis of natural products. And that's very exciting to us. And we're doing multiple things with this. But for today's talk, I'll just share one thing that's come about quite recently. And that is, in 2 of our genome sequences, we found clusters for compounds we had characterized before, including their gene clusters. So we were very glad to see them again. But what we didn't recognize from that previous work is that there were downstream regulators that were causing those compounds to be produced under natural laboratory culture conditions. Or that was the hypothesis. And to explore that hypothesis, we said, well, let's go looking for genes with that kind of a sequence elsewhere in these genomes. And we found such a one in this Papua New Guinea collection, PNG, Papua New Guinea collection, that it had a very, very 100% identity to this one from Curacao in the Caribbean. And we asked the question, so is there something upstream of it that encodes for the biosynthesis of a natural product? And indeed, we found that there was a large cluster of genes, but we did not know the product of those genes. So we were very intrigued to find out what that was. And once again, we went to our molecular networks. This time, we're just looking at the HPLC chromatogram with the various peaks as they come off, the different compounds. A couple of the compounds I mentioned that we knew were in there, we could see in the molecular networks and some analog structures, but there was this group of compounds that we did not know the structure of those compounds, and their size and atomic composition kind of matched what we could deduce from the genetic information. And so as a result, from these 2 orthogonal data sets, we actually very quickly were led to the biosynthetic gene cluster that makes this compound, as well as the structure of the compound. So this is the structure of this new compound with its very intriguing chlorine atoms and very interesting head group. And this is the biosynthetic pathway that we could deduce from the gene structure, a series of enzymes that catalyze reactions. It's a process from left to right, starting with simple precursors that are elaborated on one at a time. More atoms are added in until finally the compound is released as a completed substance in the cyanobacterium. So this is really intriguing for numerous reasons. One is, this structure caught our attention. We said that is very similar to a compound that you and I make in our bodies that binds to the cannabinoid receptor and modulates pain and cognition and memory. And that is the compound anandamide. It's binding to the cannabinoid receptor, which gets its name from the active compound in cannabis or marijuana, which is used, as you know, therapeutically for treating pain. So this compound is similar to anandamide, and so we tested it for that type of activity and found it was a very strong inhibitor of one of these receptors, but not the other. So it shows a nice selectivity and is a very intriguing lead for development in the pain management area. At the same time, we have this gene cluster. What can we do with that? Well, we're at a time in this field where that is also a very exciting discovery, because we can capture that gene cluster as a stretch of DNA coding for those enzymes, and we can harness that. We can put it into another organism and get it to produce, or we can re-engineer. We can cut out a piece and add in another piece and make new molecules. So we can do synthetic chemistry biosynthetically, and this is a very exciting frontier of the field of natural products chemistry. Okay, well, that just brings me to some final summary I'd like to make, is that sort of traditional approaches looking to nature for inspirational new molecules has gotten some new light or new breath from some innovative thinking and new techniques that we're applying to this type of area. And I think it's revealing some very bioactive leads that I'm excited by, and our pharmaceutical partners are as well. That being in a school of oceanography that's world-class and on the same campus as one that has world-class medicine and pharmacy and robust number of other departments to contribute means we can do some things here that are unique and can't be done elsewhere in the world, to my knowledge. And that finally, sort of my mantra is that I'm really very intrigued by engaging in this sort of multidisciplinary research where orthogonal approaches come to a confluence and provide opportunities for innovation and creativity that we might not otherwise have access to. So it's a wonderful to train students in this area, and just to introduce you to some of them on a recent day out on our pier looking northward to Torrey Pines. It's a great group of young people to work with. And we have wonderful facilities here. We could always use more. I mean, to accelerate the pace of the research, we could use instrumentation. Like so many things, it turns over and becomes obsolete in about half a dozen to 10 years. So we're right now at a stage of replacing our NMR spectrometers. They're about $750,000. They're expensive, and it's difficult to find those kinds of monies from the National Institutes of Health at this point. So we have needs, and I think we have great promise. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor Gowick. It's one exciting chapter after another, isn't it? Paul, can we call upon you now to come up? I'm not going to spend time introducing you. We've got these very nice descriptions on our desks. And then after this little session, I'll ask Professor Gowick and Paul to come here, and we'll have a little Q&A for 5 or 10 minutes. Okay? Thank you.
Okay, well, it's a pleasure for me to be able to be here and tell you a little bit about the research we're doing. I, too, am at Scripps Oceanography, which is part of UCSD, and I am also part of the Center for Marine Biotechnology and Biomedicine, which Bill was kind enough to introduce. And so I want to tell you a little bit about some of the things that we're doing there, and I'm going to start by posing this question to you, which I don't really need to pose to this audience because we all fully understand this problem. We see it in the news all the time. It's here. It's real. The concept that bacterial infections are now problematic and difficult to treat is something that we need to address. And so one of the questions we're interested in is how are we going to do that? And Bill Gerwick also introduced the importance of natural products for drug discovery. This picture on the left, those are three strains of bacteria inhibiting another strain of bacteria on an agar plate. And so bacteria have been killing each other in nature by producing antibiotics for millions of years. And that's one of the things that we're trying to capitalize, their natural ability to do that. There are also needs for anti-cancer drugs, of course, and other therapeutic areas. Plants have been a source of many anti-cancer agents, and the Pacific Yew is shown there, which is a source of Taxol. So natural products have historically been important. Unfortunately, in the early 1990s, the pharmaceutical industry really moved en masse away from natural products as a platform for drug discovery. They did this for a variety of reasons, and we'd be happy to discuss them later if that was of value to you. But some of the new platforms directions they elected to go did not work out very well, and that's one of the reasons why we're faced with this huge empty pipeline for new antibiotics and other sorts of drugs. So we need new resources, and where will we go to find those new resources? Well, we believe very strongly that the oceans hold great promise as a source of new medicines. And so that's what we've been doing at our center. We've been studying the oceans for this very purpose. And why? Well, of course, the oceans cover most of the planet. There's extraordinary levels of biodiversity in the oceans that we have not studied yet. And in my case, I'm particularly interested in microbes that live in the ocean. You may not recognize it, but just a few drops of seawater have about 1 million microbes in it. And if you look in sediments, about 3 orders of magnitude more. Okay, so there's extraordinary numbers of microbes living in ocean habitats, and there's extraordinary levels of diversity there as well. And so we believe these microbes represent an enormous resource for drug discovery. And so in my lab, we're particularly interested in ocean sediments, which of course cover 70% of our planet. And being at an oceanographic research institute, we have the ability to access these types of habitats. These are vast and unexplored biomes that harbor enormous microbial diversity. And here's just a little snapshot of that. Rob Knight gave a beautiful talk this morning. He didn't mention one of the tools that his lab has developed, which is called CHIME, and that's a way to rapidly analyze next-generation sequence data related to microbial diversity. And that's exactly what we've done here. These are different samples, and in each sample, each color represents a different group of microbes in that sediment sample. So you see a lot of colors, okay? And so what that tells you is that there's not just one or two dominant groups in those communities. There's just extraordinary levels of diversity, and we're very interested in exploring those different groups of microbes and the types of molecules that they make. Okay, so how do we do this work? Well, in some cases, we go to remote places around the world. This is Palmyra Atoll. It's an uninhabited atoll in the Northern Line Islands. There's a small marine lab there where you can go and visit and do some of this work. We also use our ships here at Scripps to go out and collect some of these very deep ocean sediments. And then sometimes we use scuba as well when we need to spend more time in the water to do certain types of experiments that facilitate this kind of work. And so a couple of years ago, we went to Palmyra Atoll, and we quickly isolated and described a brand new family of bacteria. This is a very higher level taxonomic group, and we named them the Moraceae after the Moore family, which is the Moore Foundation, which is supporting the research facility at Palmyra. And when we studied those bacteria, we quickly found that they made new antibiotics. Okay, so sort of proof in principle that yes, this does work. Okay, so the way we've been doing many of these discoveries, I'm going to take you through a few what I would call traditional approaches to natural product discovery, and we've had some good success with this. And so what we do is we isolate microbes, we culture them in the lab, we extract them with organic solvents, we test them in our favorite bioassay. In my lab, we culture cancer cells and antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and then we use chromatography to separate those extracts into their components and test them and ultimately isolate and solve the structures of new molecules. And I'll acknowledge my collaborator, William Fennicle, an organic chemist here who's an expert on structural elucidation, who I've collaborated with for many years on this concept of natural product drug discovery. Okay, so we've had some great success stories using these traditional approaches. I'm going to take you through two of those very quickly. Okay, and so two of the molecules that we found have entered clinical trials for the treatment of human cancer. So the first one I'll tell you about comes from another new group of bacteria that we cultured. This one is called the genus Selenospora. We described this new genus and quickly found that it made this very unusual structure that we called selenosporamide A. This molecule was active when we tested it in the laboratory in our cytotoxicity screen, and then we looked at some collaborators to find out a little more about how it might work, and in fact found that this molecule bound very tightly within the 20S proteasome. And the 20S proteasome has turned out to be a very important target for cancer chemotherapy. There's at least one drug on the market that hits this target now. There was an enormous amount of excitement for this molecule, in particular for the application multiple myeloma. And this compound, as a natural product, has passed through a number of phase one clinical trials and is being developed now by a company in Canada to enter phase two clinical trials. So we're very hopeful that this molecule continue to be developed as an anti-cancer agent. The second story, this one actually came from a marine fungus. We isolated a molecule that we called halamide and again found out that it was toxic in our assay. And in this case, and this is where the translation part becomes important, right? We can do a lot of this, okay, but the hard part is to get from that into something more advanced, something that looks like a promising candidate to go into clinical trials. And so in this case, the molecule was licensed by a small biotech company here in San Diego. They did a little bit of medicinal chemistry, and if you notice, all they did was take off that CH2 group to end up with a molecule that they called panavulin, and that increased the potency 1,000-fold. Okay, fantastic. But it not only increased the potency, but it allowed it to be revealed that this molecule actually has a very unexpected mechanism of action. It's what's called a vascular disrupting agent. And so here we have solid tumors implanted under the skin of a mouse. These are the controls. The tumors are stained in green, and there's lots of vascularization. We all know tumors need a lot of blood flow. And when treated with this drug, we see that those tumors not only shrink in size, but the vascularization starts to be disrupted, and the tumor, in effect, starts to die from the inside out. And they've been doing some clinical trials with this molecule now. It too has passed through a number of phase one clinical trials, and there's some indication that in combination with molecules that kill tumors from the outside in, that this molecule also looks quite promising. So those are some great success stories. We're very proud of those. It's not easy for us to find molecules and get them into the clinic, and we're very happy that two of them so far have made it that far. But those are traditional methods, and traditional methods can work. I would like to think that we've been a little bit insightful in the approaches we've taken that have helped given us a little bit of a heads up on how we're doing these things. But I believe there are better ways to do that now. And this is where the big data part comes in. And now what we can do is we can isolate strains and we can sequence their genomes, okay? And we can read those genome sequences using a variety of bioinformatic tools. One of which we developed, this one we developed in my lab here, and what this allows us to do is scan through those genomes and get some sense of what sorts of molecules we think they're going to make before we do any of the chemical work, before we do any of the biological testing. And one of the big challenges in natural products research is finding the same things over and over again, okay? And that's one of the reasons why the pharmaceutical industry got disinterested in natural products research for that very reason. And so now we can do this bioinformatically and start to say, let's get rid of all these strains that are going to make known things. Let's identify the ones that we think are going to make new things. And then rather than looking at thousands and thousands of strains in just one or two conditions, we can now pick the strains that we believe have the genetic capacity to make new and interesting molecules and spend lots of time on those strains trying to tease out these molecules from them. Okay, so this has really spawned a whole new field that we call genome mining, where we take strains, we sequence their genomes, we map onto those genomes all the different gene clusters that we think will make different types of secondary metabolites, and we ask which ones we think are the most interesting. We can read those gene clusters almost like a book, and we can say, this one looks really interesting. We think it's going to make a molecule that we want to look at and study more and test. And we can predict that structure, and we can go in and try to find that structure and isolate it. Okay, so this is a very new direction for natural products research. We can do that on single strains, and we can do that on many, many strains. Okay, so now we have lots and lots of genome sequences, and we can map all these gene clusters, and we can ask who's making what, who looks the most interesting. And what gets me particularly excited about this is we can go back in time, okay? We can trace the evolutionary history of how these molecules were created in these organisms by having all the sequence data. You know, here's our favorite genus again. This is Selenospora. We can predict that by a process called horizontal gene transfer, before there was a speciation event, there was an acquisition event of the genes to make these molecules, and then as they diverged, you can see the chemistry difference. Okay, so that chloroethyl group is no longer there. So we can watch how, as these bacteria evolve over time, the molecules that they make change. And then we can go in and we can look at the genes, and we can see what was gained and what was lost, and the processes that they went through to make those chemical changes. So now we can get into the even bigger data, and these things start getting enormously complex, but we can start to see some really important things. We can line lots of strains up here, and we can look at the relationships among those strains to each other based on how they group together. And then we can take all the gene clusters that they have and put them up here, and we see very clear patterns. Okay, so who you are has a big effect on what sorts of gene clusters you have. You can see this pattern here. I mean, there's very clear, obvious patterns that you can see. But then you also see, you know, there's a strain here that has something that's really rare. Maybe no one else has it. That strain belongs to a little bit of a different lineage. And so that's the molecule we're going to go after. And Bill Gerwick mentioned this, okay, this whole concept of doing metabolomics as well. Okay, so everything I talked about up to now is at the genetic level, but now we can look at the actual molecules that they're making. We can take lots and lots of strains, and we can look at these types of maps or molecular networks and ask, okay, all these things are known, we've found these already, and then we can say, what's this one? Well, when we look at this cluster, we think these molecules are interesting for a variety of reasons. We can even make some predictions about what those structures might look like and go in and find those molecules, which is exactly what we did in this case. And this was a new cytotoxic molecule that has potent anti-cancer activity. And again, a big acknowledgement to Peter Dorstein at UCSD. I mean, these are massive, massive issues with data management and handling. And Peter's been a real champion to develop this, what he calls global natural product social molecular networking. And he's created the infrastructure where all of this data can be put into one place. And everyone's putting all their data in there. And just as Bill Gerwick described, we can put all our known compounds in and we can quickly identify things that we're going to think are interesting. So in effect, what we're doing is we're taking the randomness out of the process, okay? So we're finding what looks interesting and going directly for it, as opposed to relying so much on luck. And we can tie all these things together. Again, this concept that we're calling pattern-based genome mining. We can isolate strains. We can sequence their genomes. We can look at their metabolomes. And then we can link all these things together and look for patterns. There are two strains that might be the only strains that have a certain pathway. They're the only strains that make a certain molecule. And we can start to link pathways to molecules and do these things in a much more effective sort of way. We can even take these things to the environment, okay? So we can go out, we can extract the metabolites directly from the ocean sediments before we even look at the genomes. And when we do that, we can see things that we know. I mean, we can see a molecule. We've isolated our genus Selenospora from these ocean sediments, and we can see these chemistries in those sediments where they live. So they're making them in those sediments, and we can see that, and that's fantastic. But then we can also see lots of things that we don't know what they are yet. And so we can compare different ocean sediments and say, wow, these are enriched with organisms that are making really interesting molecules, so let's focus on those particular sediments for our cultivation efforts. Okay, so to wrap all of this up, what I think I posed a problem when we started, and I think the solution, and one very important solution to finding new drugs, is to, one, explore new microbial resources. In our case, the microbes in the ocean, we believe, are extraordinarily useful for this purpose. And it's also developing these new methods, and these two new approaches are going to, we believe, continue to bring us new drug candidates. This idea of natural products research and the randomness of it is going away. This is becoming an omics-driven science now, and it's really big data that's going to drive these discoveries in the future, and we're, again, developing much more effective ways to do these things. And finally, we need to learn from the microbes themselves. Okay, so bacteria have been making antibiotics for hundreds of millions of years, they've been developing resistance to those antibiotics and basically undergoing chemical warfare for hundreds of millions of years. And we can learn from those processes. We can learn, we can watch, and we can see how they avoid resistance, how they develop better molecules to help fight resistance, and we can capitalize on the things that they know how to do a lot better than we actually know how to do. And I think by doing that, that can improve our ability to find new antibiotics and other types of medicines. Okay, so finally, again, just Bill has already showed this slide, but to acknowledge the other scientists at CNBB, and in particular, I want to acknowledge the people in my laboratory that really do all the hard work to make all this science happen. And so,
Bill, come up here, thank you. Well, we've got food for thought, and now let's have 5 minutes or so for some questions and chat together and so on. Bill, I'm going to be really stupid as an economist and not as a scientist or a chemist or a physicist. I don't know where to start, but Charles Darwin, who came from a little country I come from, I mean, he must be just looking at this as marvel. What does he think about it all?
Well, I think that is some of what Paul was getting to, and some of the now that we're accessing the genetic information that's encoding the production of these compounds, we can compare those DNA sequences. We can see lineages, and we can draw these kinds of tree diagrams, not unlike the diagram that Darwin, the one figure,
absolutely,
in his legendary book, and we can see the relationships of these compounds if they have come into being, perhaps by horizontal gene transfer, that is, you know, come from another source and then evolve separately in these different lineages. So he would be, I think he would be very excited to see this type of work.
I think he'd be very, very excited indeed. I mean, it happens to know when we look down from the planet Mars in 50 years' time and we look back on ourselves today and think, gosh, these guys have been going just so fast. And yet we've got this gap in our drug pipeline, Paul. This work you're doing is so exciting and so fundamental. It takes time. It takes time and equipment, and all our equipment costs a lot of money, and it takes a lot of time to get through it. Paul, what would be your wish just to compress things?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and it's nice to be able to address it, because what I see is that there's a gap in the research that we do, and getting from there to where we ultimately want to be. And as Bill Gerwig mentioned, you know, we have the capacity here at UCSD to take molecules from discovery all the way into the clinic and develop them as drugs. But you have to know which ones to invest in. You have to make the right decisions. And these are often very challenging decisions.
Very difficult decisions.
And so I think there's this valley, this black box where getting from the first discoveries through that black area into a real clinical candidate is an enormous challenge. Mm. And it takes a lot of interdisciplinary interaction and a lot of valuable guidance and knowledge to invest in the right things. Mm. And that remains a big challenge, but I think it's an area that we can do well with here over time.
Yes, interesting. Anybody want to chip in with a thought or a comment? Yes.
My question would be, like, how many compounds do you discover each year with the rate of discovery?
Well, let me take an initial reply to that. So the pie chart I showed was compiled by scientists at the National Cancer Institute, and they have done some outstanding jobs to kind of chronicle and measure these things. So in the area of anti-cancer drug discovery, it's about 15,000 to 20,000 compounds need to be discovered and taken through a pipeline, either natural products or synthetic compounds, whatever source, need to be taken through a bioassay to get to one compound that actually goes into the clinic. So the numbers are pretty amazing. From the marine world, we have about 23,000 known compounds and 13 drugs. So a much better track record from marine natural products than from terrestrial or other sources. Now, that was some numbers not directly related to your question, so my apologies to diverge just a little bit. But here, I think your question was more how many compounds get discovered here at SIO or UCSD on an annual basis. That's a highly variable number, but I would probably put it at, maybe 50. So the I mean, compound discovery is tough. But the other side of that coin is it's somewhat a numbers game. But as the divergence of numbers between the marine natural products and going into the clinic and all compounds together going into the clinic, it's not really just a numbers game. Hmm. It's, you know, how good are your molecules at the outset? And I think our molecules are great. Hmm. So and the numbers support that.
Paul, do you want to add anything to that comment from Bill?
No, I think Bill said that very well. It's quality, not quantity, I guess, in this sense. Yes. And so that's why, you know, but what's critical is making sure you focus on the right molecules. So you need to find the right candidates to get started with.
Great. Happy to take one more on you? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I apologize. I had to come a little late, but I've always been interested in knowing the number. So do you separate these compounds on what their targets are? Do you have, like, an idea of some natural like more natural compounds target polymerases or extracellular targets or membrane targets? Or do you see any of that kind of patterning?
Maybe we can both. Did you want to take a crack?
No, please.
There's multiple answers to that, and it would be very nice to have some discussion afterwards about that. People have applied different algorithms to the isolation process, trying to favor the isolation of compounds that would have certain biological activities, that is, compounds of a certain polarity region, or that perhaps bind specifically to a substrate that you're using to separate the compounds. So different ways to isolate compounds can lead to compounds that have certain activities. In general, the marine world has yielded an outstanding number of new anti-cancer compounds. And you might ask the question, why is that? Well, I think it's in part that it's a very competitive environment, and so there's a lot of interspecies competition to live on that rock and defend that turf and access nutrients and sunlight. And so there is a lot of chemical warfare going out there, which is not dissimilar to what we're trying to do when we treat cancer. We're trying to kill those cells. But I think there's other areas, like in the neurosciences, which we've just underexplored at the present time.
Good.
But Paul, if I can add to that, I would say the National Cancer Institute's been a huge supporter of marine natural products research, and so a lot of us have written grants to the National Cancer Institute, so we're looking by definition for anti-cancer agents, and that doesn't mean that a lot of these molecules don't have other valuable biomedical activities. And if we talked about another area where, you know, I think things could be improved, and Bill Gerwig's actually been a bit of a champion of this, and that is trying to get all our molecules into libraries that can be tested more broadly, mm-hmm. because by and large we have no idea what sort of targets these molecules might hit. And a lot of our activities are driven by our funding sources, and that's just the way the academic world works. But to have better libraries and better access to broader screening, we would certainly find that there were lots of activities that we don't yet know about.
Good question. Well, look, thank you very much indeed.
Paul Bill? Brought up, I just want to make a plug. We've started a new center with some funding from the Chancellor. I have helped to co-direct this at the start here, is to develop a center, a UCSD Center for Compound Resources, where we're going to pull the compounds from all the different laboratories together and then put them through this rich suite of biological assays that are present here on the campus as well as in the La Jolla Mesa. So that's an exciting opportunity for the future.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been spoiled by two stars of the Scripps School, and thank you both very, very much indeed.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.